Hello, and welcome to Talk the Talk, the podcast where we explore people, partnerships, and projects shaping the future of union construction and industrial innovation. Our guest today is a powerhouse in the world of occupational safety and health. As executive director of CPWR, the research and training arm of North America's building trades unions, Chris Kane leads the charge on creating safer, healthier, and more resilient construction job sites. She spent her career bridging the gap between science and the job site, championing data-driven approaches to everything from fall prevention to mental health. Under her leadership, CPWR has launched some of the industry's most impactful safety campaigns, combining research, outreach, and training to protect the lives of men and women who build this country. She's here to share what the latest data tells us about safety, what risks are rising, and how labor and management can work together to create job sites that don't just get the job done, but get everyone home safe. Please welcome Chris Kane. So before we kick off, I want to start with what will undoubtedly be the most important question I ask you for this day. And that is, what is the last song that you got stuck in your head?
There haven't been many stuck in there lately.
Really?
It's been pushed out by all my other concerns.
Fair enough. We've had some really fun answers to that, like the Sophia the First theme song. And, you know, lots of people have kids. So it's always kind of fun to, you know, hear what gets stuck in there.
Actually, I do have kids, and I don't know if I can say the name of the song because of the profanity involved.
Fair enough. So you've spent your career championing safety and worker well-being. How did you get to doing this in the first place? How did you get here?
I started my career wanting to do OSHA enforcement, and I did that for a couple of years, and I decided to move to Washington, D.C., and you know, I've worked in the private sector and I've worked in the public sector, and I really wanted to work for the unions. And I was lucky enough after I moved down here for a couple of years to find a job working for the building trades unions at a different nonprofit. And it was really felt like coming home. Just the work that is worthwhile and it's beneficial, and there's a lot of partnerships involved and trying to move policy, which is almost impossible, but also trying to educate the workforce and contractors has been just really satisfying.
So as executive director of CPWR, what does your day look like? You said policy is hard to move. Like, what is the day-to-day of working with the CPWR? How does that work?
Well, that's a great question because I was trained as an industrial hygienist, and that's a profession that's aimed at reducing chemical and other risks that cause illness in workers. So from a prevention standpoint, and as the executive director, I don't get to do enough industrial hygiene because running an organization like CPWR is like running a business, and you have to manage paying the bills and hiring the right people and ensuring staff has a good working condition and helping staff accomplish their goals and moving all the goals along with our organization's mission is more of what I do instead of industrial hygiene these days. And our mission is really just about trying to improve working conditions for construction workers in the United States. So it's a pretty broad mission, and trying to make sure this kind of diverse group of people who work at CPWR and our diverse network of partners are all working on that same thing is the fun part of running the business.
What are some of those top safety challenges you're seeing across all of the industry right now? What are the pressing concerns of the contractors out there?
There's different kind of buckets we put the challenges in safety and health into. And when you think about safety and health, you think about trying to prevent traumatic injuries that cause death or debilitating injuries or longer-term injuries. But then there's also the health side, where you're trying to prevent chemical exposures or other types of physical hazard exposures that cause disease. So there's those kind of two buckets, and thinking about what are the different pressure points in each of those two buckets. And of course, what's been added onto the plate of safety and health professionals in the last 10 years is the diseases of despair that have come into play in our industry that claim large number of lives, both on the job site and off the job site. And I'm talking about death by suicide and opioid overdose. So if you think about the traditional persistent hazards of trying to control workers from falling and becoming injured or dying, or being crushed in a trench collapse. Those are still there. And the fight is still daily. It's not like we've solved those simple, relatively straightforward problems. But there's also the whole world of these health exposures. You know, we got a silica standard in the last 20 years, and we think that's led to a great decrease in silica-related deaths, but it's still happening. People are ignoring the standard in some cases. But now we're thinking about how to control exposure to heat and what are some ways that we can manage that hazard so that somebody doesn't become ill or die from the heat exposure. So that on the health side, there's always that, and there's always some other new things popping up that hit our radar, like PFAS or a new technology potentially creating a health risk. But then there's, like I said, the diseases of despair, which have become really consuming for a lot of our industry and also have a lot of attention on them from the contractors and our other partners in the industry and the unions. And we're all trying to figure out, you know, what are some of the best ways to deal with that whole set of issues and things that cause bad outcomes in our industry.
So obviously CPWR is often equated with their data. You guys are big on research. And how do you best collect your data just to ensure that you're getting good information?
That's a great question. And we do not do a lot of data collection per se, because collecting large amounts of data to use your own collected data to answer the big questions is so cost prohibitive. It's incredibly expensive to run nationally representative surveys. But most of the data that we rely on are large nationally available data sets that we can use to draw conclusions about the industry. And we look at the industry from the safety and health perspective. So we look for outcomes related to traumatic injury on the job. And that's through CFOI data from BLS. You know, that's the Census of Fatal Occupational Injuries, through the Bureau of Labor Statistics. We also look to large data sets that exist outside of our collection to try to draw health outcomes. And there's different data sets that we use to track the overdoses and the suicides. And we have other data sources where we look to track bad health outcomes like silicosis or hearing loss. So there's a lot of different data sources that are used and manipulated and understood at CPWR by our data team that we don't know if there's another group that does what we do. We know, we don't think in construction, but even outside of construction, it's just a pretty incredible opportunity we have to really study the trends and be able to report on them. To that end, I'll put in a plug. We're in the process of publishing our chart book, which is kind of like our flagship publication. Over the years of CPWR, it's been published on paper, and we moved it to electronic version in the last issue, which was back in 2018. So this will be published by the end of August. So hopefully by the time your listeners hear this, they can go to our website and see all of the components of what we call the construction chart book. And that tracks everything related to injuries, illnesses, looks at all of our data sets in that regard, but also employment, economic data, things about wages and health insurance. And what do the business owners in the construction industry in the U.S. look like? What are the different sizes and different experiences of business owners? And we look at things related to trends and demographics in our industry, both of business owners and workers. So stay tuned. That's coming out, or it should be out. And that's really exciting for us. We are going to print it. We'll have some print copies available, but it'll be available on our website for free as a fully interactive reference manual for the construction industry.
That's awesome. And that'll be available just on the CPWR website?
Yes. And it's mostly available now. We're adding to it in stages, but the final book will be brought together by the end of August.
Awesome. We'll make sure to put a link to that in the show notes so that anyone listening can find that really easily.
Fabulous.
So as I've done it on a few different projects, compiling a book of all those campaigns, all of those research sets can be a lot. Is there a specific campaign or set research effort that you have seen develop a lot over the last few years that we've seen some real strides taking?
I think the main thing that's different over the last few years, like I mentioned before, is the attention to trying to prevent suicides and overdoses. And I think that it's a challenge for our industry for many reasons, but it's also a challenge that I see people give up on pretty easily because they think that it's just somebody with a mental health disorder, there's nothing I can do, or it's just someone who's using illicit drugs, there's nothing I can do. But where I think we're making strides is thinking about this more in the work context. And the research shows us different elements of things that are specific to the construction industry that are associated with the bad outcomes. For example, our working hypothesis or our working agenda to reduce fatal opioid overdoses, starting with safety on the job site, right? You want to create a safe job site where people don't injure their back or their knees, moving material around unnecessary, use smart methods to eliminate injuries that cause pain. Workers who have pain may not have access to paid leave, so they work through pain, and sometimes to do that, they go on prescribed opioids. We've been tracking the use of prescribed opioids in construction workers for probably 2 decades now, and what we see is we still see that about a quarter, maybe a little bit more, of construction workers who have musculoskeletal injuries are on prescribed opioids. So that path to dependency and then addiction and then ultimately overdose is something we can do something about, is by making construction work sites safer, eliminating the development of pain, treating pain appropriately, potentially giving somebody time off to allow their micro injury to heal, are all things that we can do in our industry that actually prevent death by overdose, is what we want to see. We want to change the industry. And it's a way to think about these diseases of despair with hope and also with action. Similarly, with construction suicides, there's a whole bunch of data that points to things like getting rid of bullying on the job and intimidation as a way to reduce construction suicide, because there's a direct line between bullying and suicide and a whole bunch of different types of demographics. So if we get rid of this on the job, we're working to improve the ultimate outcomes. So it's not just about these big problems that are overwhelming. It's about regular problems that we've just got to break down into the right size boxes that we can tackle and take care of.
I think it's really important. I've personally seen the people who you referenced it already, who they're like, well, I can't help that. That's just a mental illness, or I can't help that. That's their addiction, you know, who kind of draw a line between the workplace environment and the personal afflictions and despair.
Yeah. And there's always going to be people with mental health disorders or mental illness, right? And there's always going to be people who develop an opioid use disorder through illicit means. Thinking about the people who develop these disorders through worksite cause factors is how we can influence the outcome. You know, it's not about trying to save everyone on the precipice or catch people as they're falling. It's more about trying to put up the barriers to interrupt the development of a disorder or a disease, just like occupational safety and health.
Absolutely. Want to get your company message in front of the top leaders in union construction? Place an ad on Talk the Talk. Our listeners are owners, contractors, and labor leaders who shape the future of our industry. It's a direct way to reach a powerful, engaged audience and show your support for union construction. Learn more about advertising opportunities at talk.org. How do you balance? I mean, some of these things feel like emergencies. We need to stop this right now, but a lot of these data takes a long time, as you said, to aggregate and kind of dig through. How do you guys dig through and balance between the long-term research and those needs to respond quickly to some of these emergent and pressing hazards?
We see that in construction, a lot of firms start out very small, and they typically don't stay super, super small for decades, right? They either grow or they go away and different firms pop up. So you're always dealing with kind of a new group of small businesses that are coming into our industry, and they don't have resources. They don't have safety personnel. They don't have an HR department. They don't have anything except the ability to try to chase work and perform work. So everything else is not happening in the smallest of the firms unless they start to become successful and grow. And then they start to have the resources to add a safety person or add an HR person to start actually managing their business more like a business. So you have this flow of companies that are always new, are always small, and are always have situations with the least controlled risk. So that's the challenge, I think. And that's the challenge for not just groups like CPWR, organizations like us, or the government trying to intervene. I think it's challenges also for the larger contractors. Large or mid-sized contractors started out small, so they remember that. But they also may have the ability to influence what's going on in the smalls. A lot of large contractors hire small employers as specialty trade contractors or hire smalls to do a specific job that is not particularly in the expertise of their own workforce. So thinking about that, you know, what role can the larger companies play to help the smalls along and to help educate the small employers on how to do business safely? I think there's always opportunity there. And we really look to the sophisticated contractors to lead the way, but also to help spread the word and spread good safety practices to the smaller firms they hire.
Awesome answer. And now dovetailing right into that, actually, like you said, there's always these small contractors either grow or go away as these other, but also at the exact same time, the backdrop of the construction industry or the whole world right now is change. We have new tech, we have new materials, there's new risks. On top of the old risks that didn't go away, we have these new emerging trends. How can we help the industry keep up?
I think it's related to, you know, the thing we were just talking about. You know, there'll always be forward-thinking early adopters, large contractors, sophisticated, who are leading the way in technology and who are using technologies to control risk. What we are trying to understand is how some of the technology that's coming out, be it crash avoidance systems for highway work zones or wearables to detect when someone becomes dehydrated, you know, or all the other VR and AR type training programs. All of these technologies are out there and being used by the larger firms. But how do we get them adopted by the smaller firms? It's kind of the biggest challenge, especially when it's the same person who owns the company who's trying to win work and who's performing the work along with his three workers. So the group that would probably be aided the most by the technology is the least likely to know of its existence, number one, and number two, have the resources to invest and to see the opportunity for return of that investment.
So how can contractors and union leaders help with that? How do we foster a safety culture that goes beyond compliance for those small guys? How do we get that information, that tech, and that next-gen stuff to the people that, like you said, are the one person is bidding work, taking work, and doing work? How do we win?
I don't know if winning equates to getting high tech into every small contractor's hands. I think it might help. I think we're trying to foster that and to promote it. But when you think about occupational safety and health, when you're in a large firm, you think about it as part of your risk control, your overall risk control.
Right.
So you invest in trying to control that risk because as a large firm, you understand that that investment pays off. Where the disconnect happens in the smallest firms is that number one, they don't have money to invest. And number two, the experience is not broad enough or large enough to observe that investment in safety controls or technology pays off for them. So I don't know if technology is the answer. I know that the experience of small contractors is incredibly dependent upon who they're working for. And the safety practices of those small contractors is 100% on who they're working for, be it an owner or a larger contractor. All of that flows downstream. That's well documented. And we've also documented that once that small contractor leaves the oversight of the large contractor, the safety practices don't necessarily follow the small contractor away. What does that mean? That means that we have to take more seriously the role of owners and the role of large contractors hiring subs into consideration when we try to improve small contractor safety and health.
So we really are looking for the big brother. And I mean that in the good way, not the big brother in the government sense of the word, but the making sure that the larger contractors and the unions are being good stewards and a good big brother to the smaller guys.
I think that's the answer. And that's what we have actually seen work. It would be great if we had a silver bullet that we could say this technology is going to stop falls for the fall experience and change the fall experience of all the smallest contractors in the world. But we just don't have that. And we don't have one construction industry either. You know, we have multiple construction industries. And I think that when you talk about the large firms that are probably listening to this podcast, you know, they understand their role in overseeing their subs and instilling good safety programs in their subs. So in the really organized, in the well-structured and well-heeled side of construction, I think this takes care of itself. It's really when you get to the point where you have a very small entity hiring the other small entity that, you know, this theory would be only proven if the smallest entity that hires the smallest entity agrees that safety and health is of utmost importance. So that might be the answer.
So, I mean, you referenced the listeners, you know, talk members are 1,800 strong companies, 1,800 companies ranging from the biggest in the biz that you've absolutely heard of, if I named them off, all the way down to these other companies you're talking about, these small one-man, two-man shops, specialty contractors, and, you know, they're all very deeply invested in safety. But how can these contractors better partner with you and be a part of that solution? What does being a good team member look like for our listeners?
I think you've kind of hit the nail on the head. It really changes depending upon the sophistication of the contractor and the contractor's size, and if they have safety people. But I think anyone in the construction industry is invited to listen to CPWR's webinars, which we do tend to turn into podcasts and post from time to time. We're not as good as some groups are in getting them out on time. But there is so much educational material available for free from CPWR for the construction industry and for everyone in the construction industry. It's a matter of, you know, convincing them to avail themselves of that. And, you know, this has been brought to us by our tax dollars too. I want to stress that CPWR's research program is funded through a cooperative agreement with NIOSH, the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health. So, as such, you know, we have been funding research, doing the work of translating what comes out of these researchers into actionable information tools and guidance for the construction industry. We call that research to practice, as well as watching all the data and the data sets and reporting on them, all through our cooperative agreement with the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, NIOSH. And because of that, I view that our work is a public service and for the public good and is available for free for everyone in the public. So I just hope that people take advantage of that while we have it, because I don't know if you've heard, but NIOSH is in great jeopardy in this administration. Most NIOSH staff was fired on April 1st, and we were told that we would not be funded anymore. But we have received an agreement to be funded by NIOSH for another year. We hope that it holds and they don't cancel it, so we can continue to bring our resources, information, and education to the public. So yeah, stay tuned. It's, you know, really an honor to do this work. And we do believe we're in public service doing this work. We don't gatekeep any of our research or research products or education, and everything we do is available for free. So,
well, Chris, I really do appreciate your time. And I didn't know the full extent of that with the agreement with NIOSH and everything. And that's big, because safety and health is a culture that we have to continue to try and grow. And we'd be potentially losing some resources is not a good thing. So we want to make sure that we can get everyone rallied and using those resources while they exist, should they go away.
Well, you know, I think what we saw the Senate do with appropriations is very encouraging, because the president's fiscal year 2026 request, which starts October 1st, had NIOSH slated to be completely, almost completely eliminated, a very few functions left, excluding construction as a focus area. But the Senate appropriations for FY 2026 fully restored NIOSH, and we're hoping that the House does the same and that they pass an appropriations bill that continues to support NIOSH. But time, well, yeah, we'll see how that goes. We'll see what happens with that.
Well, thank you so much for your time. This has been great, and we will look out for your report. What'd you call it again? Your big book?
The Construction Chart Book.
The Construction Chart Book. I will look forward to that coming out. You said here just in a few weeks, and by the time this comes out, it should be out.
Hopefully.
Awesome. Thank you so much for your time, Chris.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Chris, thank you for your leadership and for showing how research, training, and trust can come together to make this industry safer for everyone. Your work reminds us that safety isn't a box to check. It's a culture to build.